All right, so let's get started. I'm Dan Liebling from the Clues Group in Microsoft Research. It's my pleasure to introduce Joe Shepard, professor of aeronautics and mechanical engineering at Caltech. He got his PhD from Caltech actually in 1981, and he studies fluid and solid dynamics, combustion chemistry, thermodynamics with applications to explosions, propulsion, high speed light, energy, technology, and medical devices. Today he's going to talk to us about the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear incident and the 6 years that have come after that. So, welcome.
Thank you very much, Dan. Well, it's a pleasure to be here and be able to talk to you about this topic. It's something that I have been involved with in some ways since this event happened, but it's something I feel like I've been preparing for my whole professional career. I started out as a physicist and spent a summer at Oak Ridge working on a nuclear reactor there, and I thought that was the last I was going to see of that. And then later on, when I got a job at Sandia Labs, this was just after Three Mile Island, and in 1980, and they immediately put me to work. They said, "Shepard, you did something on explosions. All right, you're in charge of this hydrogen research for Three Mile Island." And so that's how I backed into this career, as many things happens in careers. And for the last 4 years, I've been involved with the National Academy of Science study that's been looking at what happened at Fukushima. And what I'd like to do today is tell you about some of the things that I've learned along the way. First, what I'd like to do is talk to you a little bit about nuclear energy in Japan, just to sort of set the stage. So Japan has been heavily reliant before March 11, 2011, on the nuclear energy. You can see from the chart on the right-hand side, they were getting almost 30% of their electricity from nuclear power before the earthquake and tsunamis that happened on that day. And you can see on the left, you can see all of the plants and how they're positioned around the coast of Japan. And of course, they're positioned around the coast because they need to use the cooling water from the ocean. And many of these plants have, as you can count from the number of squares, a very large number of reactors. And so this is an economy of scale effort. And so once you've built one plant, you have a lot of infrastructure there with one reactor. And so for example, in one place in Kajiwazaki, Kariwa, they have seven reactors at that particular plant. So multiple reactors. This is a little unusual in the United States. The situation is we typically only have one or two reactors per plant. So this was their status at that time, and one of the things you can see is since that time they've had to really increase their reliance on oil and natural gas and coal. And of course, there is coal in Hokkaido, but not much of it, and so almost all of these energy sources are imported. So about 80% of the energy is imported into Japan, and this creates a significant issue for their balance of payments in the world. Let's talk a little bit about nuclear power plants. They come in sort of two species. One's called a boiling water reactor, and the other is called a pressurized water reactor. And the difference just has to do with how many heat exchangers do you have between yourself and the nuclear fuel. The boiling water reactor was an effort to produce a simpler reactor than the pressurized water reactor that was first developed to power the nuclear submarines, and about 30% of the reactors in the world have this design. And basically, you have a core in which the nuclear reactions take place, and that generates steam at high pressure. That steam then is used to turn the turbines that in turn the generators that make the electricity. Like any thermal power plant, if you just look at the Carnot efficiency of this, you'll find out that about two-thirds of the energy that's generated by the prime heat source, the nuclear fission, actually just goes into waste. And so it has to be dumped somewhere. And this is a really important aspect. And one of the things that causes a great deal of difficulty in some cases. For example, if you're going to put it back into a river or an ocean, it raises the temperature near the exit, and that influences significantly the biota and the biology of the various marine life that's there. So the these things run on water. They use a huge amount of water. You can see that 6 tons of water a second have to go through this reactor, and then you have a very large amount of water that has to be circulated through that condenser. Moving all that water around takes an enormous amount of electricity, and so that's something that's important to keep in mind. You know, these plants generate electricity, but they need electricity to run. For stability, you do not want to use these plants to generate the electricity that actually runs the plant. You want to use an external electricity source. They got in a lot of trouble at Chernobyl. They tried to use the electricity the plant generated to actually run the plant, and that's one of the reasons why they wound up blowing up that reactor. Now, the reactors that were at Fukushima that caused so much difficulty were the boiling water reactors. They're referred to as a Mark I. That's because it was the first design that GE had developed in the late 50s and the 1960s. These reactors were at Fukushima were built between 1970 and 1983. There's actually six reactors there, four of them of this design, Mark I design. This Mark I design is a design that has a reactor pressure vessel that contains the nuclear fuel, and it has a large concrete structure reactor building around it. Inside of it is a light bulb-like shape, which is called the primary containment. And then they have a feature which is called a suppression pool, which is used to condense steam if you have some sort of release of steam. It also has the interesting feature that the spent fuel is stored in a large swimming pool that's located adjacent to the reactor, but isolated by very thick concrete walls up near the top of this building. You can see in the little insert on the left-hand side there are four squarish rectangular buildings where the reactor buildings, the lower buildings to the front of that are actually where the turbine halls were, where the turbines and the generators were. And what you can see just down in the lower corner is that's the quay, because it's next to the Pacific Ocean there. So what makes this thing go? Well, it's really the fuel, which is located inside of this large pressure vessel, the 6-inch thick, 500 tons of steel. In a boiling water reactor, the steam that comes out is what engineers call wet. That means that it's got some amount of droplets in it. You can't have droplets going to the turbine. They're bad for the blades. And so it has a steam separator and a steam dryer. And so it's got a lot of equipment that's on the top of the pressure vessel. And so for that reason, they have to put the control blades in the bottom. The way you control the power output of one of these things is you have a set of control blades which are made out of boron carbide. Turns out boron is a very good neutron absorber. And when you push those control blades in between the fuel assemblies, you can basically turn off the chain reaction. Now, that doesn't turn off the heat generation, and that's important. We'll talk about that later on. You also have actually pumps inside of this reactor pressure vessel that are used to circulate the water around the core, this 6 tons a second. And there's additional pumps that are outside. So this is the business end of it. If you have about 33 tons of partially enriched uranium, that is, it has about 3% U-235 and the rest of it is 238, you can generate a gigawatt of electricity for a year with 33 tons. And that's one of the real attractions of nuclear power plants, is being able to use such a modest amount of material and generate a large amount of electricity. So, yeah. Now, normally what's happening is you're circulating water through this plant. When you circulate the water through the reactor pressure vessel, it comes in as a liquid and it goes out as steam. And then after it goes through the turbines, it gets condensed and recirculated. It's a closed loop system. You have to have a little makeup, but basically it's a closed loop system. This system, because it is such a small containment, there was concerns after Three Mile Island that if you have an accident, there's the potential to generate hydrogen gas. I'll talk about that a little later on. And so for that reason, they actually fill this light bulb-shaped structure, which is colored in gray here, with nitrogen. And so it's inerted with nitrogen while you're operating the reactor. Yes?
Water that's been desalinated or something?
No, this actually is water that has very carefully controlled chemistry, and it actually has some additives in it and so on to reduce corrosion. And so the seawater is on the other side of the condenser, and so that's we try to keep that isolated from each other. Now, turns out that during the accident, they wound up having to use seawater, but basically that's something you never want to have happen in normal operation. What happened on March 11th, 2011? Well, they had a really terrible catastrophe there in Japan. They had an enormous earthquake. It's the largest earthquake recorded in history of Japan, which is about, goes back at least 1,000 years. This massive undersea thrust fault, which had 50 meters slip and a 7 meters vertical motion in a magnitude, moment magnitude 9, so-called. There's only been four other earthquakes of that size since 1900 in the world. Yeah.
Embassy in Tokyo.
Wow, were you?
This way.
Yeah.
But in Tokyo, we only had about 2 fatalities. Well, 4 total. There is minimal considering the magnitude.
Do you think, in part, that was due to the preparedness that they have in Japan for earthquakes?
Most of the skyscrapers were designed to sway.
Yeah.
So not even too many structural damages, but I think also that we were little far away from the epicenter.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that must have been quite an experience for you. That's the shaking went on also for some time. If you look at the graph here in the bottom, you can see these are, I believe those are magnitudes of the shocks that took place afterwards. Very large number of aftershocks, and the shaking went on, as you can see up at the top, for probably 100 seconds. So it was, then there was a very large permanent change in the elevation of the land, as you can see from the red and blue contours on the upper right-hand side. This was a tremendously destructive event. It's the amount of energy that's released can be crudely estimated, and I looked at that, and it's the equivalent of, I don't know if this will mean anything to anyone here in the room, but the largest thermonuclear weapon that we have in our stockpile is the B-61 bomb, which is 340 kilotons, and it's equivalent to about 170 of those was the energy released in this earthquake. So it's just a massive amount of energy that was released when it slipped. One of the things that happened was of the destruction of the infrastructure broadly throughout that part of Japan, and part of that infrastructure that was destroyed was the pylons for the electricity transmission. There were 6 transmission lines that went into Fukushima Daiichi, and they all were destroyed, and so they had no power coming from off-site. Now, if you recall, there's 6 tons a second normally circulating through this reactor, but now we've shut the reactor down. The control blades, which come in from the bottom, have been pushed up in between the 30,000 or so fuel rods that are here in the core. But what's happening is we have a lot of unstable fission products that were produced in the course of nuclear fission, and there's a whole chain of decay that occurs because they are unstable. They have too many neutrons to be stable. This process cannot be stopped. It's spontaneous. There's absolutely nothing you can do about this. This nature is going to do this. And when it, every time it does this, it releases about 1 million electron volts per decay, and that million electron volts is going to go into thermal energy. So you're still generating a very large amount of thermal energy, and so you have to keep this thing cool. So this is a sketch of what happens. It's a little more than a sketch. It's pretty quantitative. As soon as you shut the reactor down, you're still making about 6% of the full thermal power. These have a very large amount of thermal power, so 2 of the units were making almost 2,400 megawatts of thermal energy. So you're still getting 6% of that even after you put in your control blades. And it takes many days, as you can see here on the right, 60 days to get down to about 1.5% of that. So you really have to wait quite some time. And during this period of time, you have to actively cool the reactor. So now this is something that's very well understood, it's very well known, and it's something that was prepared for from the very outset. In fact, the general design requirements that we have in the United States that most countries have copied require you to have multiple redundant means of keeping the electricity going and also keeping the cooling going. And so one of the primary things that you do right away, because loss of offsite power is something that actually occurs from time to time, even without natural disasters like this event on 311. And this, they have a number of emergency diesel generators. These are very large generators. They had actually 13 of these at Fukushima Daiichi. Then, so the emergency diesel generators come on. They also have very large banks of batteries. You can see some of the batteries here, and those batteries are a backup to the generators. These batteries power inverters that feed AC back into a separated power system. So the power system is divided into multiple areas, and some power systems are redundant and some are rated for safety and has seismic ratings because of the knowledge that this type of event could happen. These batteries have enough capacity for about 8 hours normally of operation. The thing that happened about 50 minutes after the earthquake, because of this very large thrust, this so-called mega thrust, this 7 meters of displacement of the seafloor, was it generated very strong tsunamis, which are long wavelength waves in the ocean. If you're out to sea, you can barely tell they're going by you, but as they run up onto the shore, the amplitude increases dramatically, and that's just conservation of energy and momentum. And here's a picture looking down, and you can see the plant here, and it has a breakwater that's around it. And offshore, you can see in the water this white frothy heads of the waves as they're coming in at an angle to the breakwater. The waves were in this area about 10 to 15 meters was the peak crest height. And it turns out that that breakwater, that seawall, was about 5.5 meters high. And so they overtopped that breakwater, and they ran up onto shore. And as they run up onto shore, they have a lot of energy in that water. It takes a long time for it to stop. And it ran up hundreds of yards onto the shore. And here you can see it overtopping in the upper left the seawall. There's a quay that sits down there next to the water where they make deliveries, and they have these large oil tanks. You can also see in the upper right there the cars that are now look like little toys swimming in the water. And then down below, we're actually looking at the back of the plant. This is behind the turbine buildings, behind the reactor buildings, and you can see how much water has actually flowed in there. And then over on the lower right, you can see a car is upended and sitting vertically next to the building. That gives you a sense of the scale. So it's a tremendously destructive event, all of this water that came in. And this water amount completely exceeded any of the previous expectations that they had had. They were in the process of raising the height of the seawall, but they had never imagined that such a large tsunami would occur. The consequence of this was, yes?
So even though the protection from tsunami was inadequate, I assume that it was on purpose that they built the reactors right next to the ocean.
Yes, yeah, all of your almost every, unless you use a cooling tower system, almost all of the, not only nuclear power plants, but thermal plants have to be built next to a large, what they call ultimate heat sink. And it's got to be,
Output of the heat.
That's right. That 70% of the energy that Carnot says you cannot use has to go somewhere. And so one of the ways you can do is put it into the atmosphere with cooling towers. That avoids having to be near a large body of water, but That is takes a very large number of cooling waters there, cooling towers, and usually it's a lake or a river or an ocean. In Japan, they use the oceans. Yeah.
Close proximity to the shore just to minimize pumping?
So here's a very good point, because that's actually a deliberate choice they made. They actually cut the cliff down quite a bit to move the whole plant closer to the ocean. It was a bad choice in hindsight. And I bet that that's my phone going off, so I'm going to go silence it. Sorry about that. So they made a choice because, yes, it costs you a lot of energy to have to pump that uphill. And those pumps are enormous that they use to pump the cooling water into the condensers. And north at the Onagawa plant, they did not make that choice. And in fact, they were much better off. They also made some very poor design decisions in that they did not seal the buildings against the intrusion of water, so they did not protect them from flooding. The doors and the ventilation systems and so on were not protected against flooding. So as a consequence, the turbine building and the lower floors of the reactor buildings were all flooded. And you can see that flooding here has gone into the motors, and it actually went into, what was even worse, all the switch gears. And it turned out they put a lot of the switch gear down in the bottom of the building. That's a natural place to put it if you're an electrical designer. And they also had put a lot of the diesel generators in the bottom of the buildings. Yeah.
The spent fuel up in upper floors, was it to protect against this?
Yeah, so the reason why they put the spent fuel there, they don't do that in all plants, but in this BWR plant, it makes it particularly convenient to move the fuel underwater and use the water as a biological shield from the reactor into the pool. And so that's why they put it up there at the top. Well, they're actually at comparable letters. I'll show a picture that makes that a little clearer. But there's a little bit of raising and lowering that goes on, but their levels are fairly close to each other. Other plants, like PWR plants, often have a transfer line that lowers the fuel down and puts it outside of the reactor, near the ground level. 12 of the backup generators out of 13 failed. They also flooded all the switch gear, so even if the generators hadn't failed, they would not have been able to supply power. Many of the battery rooms were flooded also. You can see here the kind of debris, what's in the background that you can't tell very well, but it's the pumps that are the main seawater pumps that run the condensers were here, and they were also destroyed. This left them completely in the dark in some cases. In Unit 1, the lights went out. This is called station blackout. And this is what the operators were reduced to in terms of operating. They were using headlamps and emergency lights. And they also had no guidance of how to deal with this. It turned out their manuals kind of ended where this accident began. And they were really completely unprepared. And so they actually did many things, improvised many things. It's a tremendous number of lessons here for the resilience of a group of individuals when faced with this sort of catastrophe. But you know, ultimately, the responsibility really goes back to the organization that failed to have really foresee and prepare them in any way for this. But it is actually an extraordinarily difficult thing to prepare for, and one of the questions is how much can you prepare for something like this? So they're in a very difficult situation at this point. They have almost no electrical power. They don't have any ability to read out the positions of the valves. They don't know what the temperatures and the pressures are. They're not sure if they have some emergency cooling systems that may or may not be operable. And it was an extraordinarily difficult time. And there was a really dedicated leader there at the plant, and Yoshida, and he led the group of engineers to try to struggle with all these difficulties, and they did some things that were with great courage, I would say. And ultimately, though, they were not able to keep the reactors from melting down. One of the things that happened that's a lesson in technology is they had a very effective system in one of the units, the first one that was built, which is just simply natural convection cooling. They had a large, what they called an isolation condenser, and the plan was that if you had an accident of this type, you would just open up the valves and you would let the water circulate and boil off through a heat exchanger and boil off this large pool of water, and that would serve to remove the heat. And so you could get rid of all the electricity, and you could just let it sit there and do that. The only problem was it had a series of valves. The valves were connected to a logic control system. They also needed, in some cases, air, and in some cases, they were motor-operated. And the order of failure of the electricity to the logic control system, the air, and the motor operators was such that it left some of the valves in a closed state or an unknown state, close to closed, so that it was essentially inoperable. And so it was really a flaw in how the system was engineered and designed, but it was a corner condition. If you think about it as an engineer, it was a condition that you would seldom expect to visit, but they did. Now, there's another thing that you can do in this reactor, and that is you have a very large pool of water in this torus that's at the bottom. And so if we look at this picture, you can see there's a cross-section. You see these two large circular regions down at the bottom that are half full of water. It's labeled suppression pool. Those are designed to condense steam, and what they have is steam-driven pumps. The reactor is still generating heat. Remember, you have this decay heat. It generates steam. That drives a turbine. The turbine drives a pump. And what you do is you condense the steam in the suppression pool, and then you pump that warm water back through the reactor. And this will work until you run out of water in those suppression pools. You're actually designed to have an active cooling mechanism. And so there is a further set of heat exchangers, which will remove heat from those. But unfortunately, because the electricity was off, those heat exchangers aren't working. So what's going to happen is you're just eventually going to heat that water up to the point where the pumps cavitate and they don't work. The suppression pool is a very large torus. You can see some of the outside of it here, and you can see the piping networks that connect the suppression pool into the containment. So we have the suppression pools. We have the isolation condenser that didn't work. We have the reactor cooling isolation condenser system that was working, but at an unknown amount because we don't have any instrumentation to tell what's going on. And one of the things that they tried to do then, and with a little bit of success, is they went and they found batteries to run the equipment off of. And you can see here a picture of a control panel for the reactor, a set of batteries down at the bottom. At one point, they actually went and broke into the cars in the parking lot and got the batteries to try to run the equipment. You needed about 110 volts DC, and so you had to get a large number of batteries and string them together in series. They didn't have the equipment to do that, so they had to break into the maintenance sheds to find the equipment. So they went through some quite arduous efforts to try to just know what was going on. We wanted to know what was the water level, what was the pressures, what was the temperatures. And also, ultimately, they wanted to be able to actuate the valves to try to execute some mitigation actions. One of the things that they did, and they had fire trucks there because they had had a fire at this plant that was on the west coast of Japan, and they had had a fire in 2007 after an earthquake, so they had put fire trucks at all of the plants, and these fire trucks they knew they could take those fire trucks and they could try to use these to pump water into their reactors, because as the water in the suppression pool is boiling off and the water level in the reactor is going down, they're getting very close to uncovering the fuel. The prime directive in this business is keep the fuel covered. Whatever you do, you got to keep the fuel covered and you got to keep it cool. You can maybe have it a little bit uncovered, but not for too long. So you can see all the lines here. and their efforts to try to pump the water in. Because the reactors have such a complex plumbing system, it turns out probably a lot of these efforts were for naught, because they did not have, all in the parlance of the engineers, all the valves lined up, and so the water probably did not, much of it probably did not go into the reactors. So what's happening now is we're, turns out it only took probably a matter of 6 to 8 hours for this to happen in the unit one, and it took some longer time to happen in the other units, is that, you know, you've got this loss of power, you're boiling off the water, you're heating up the suppression pool, but ultimately the water level drops down below the top of the fuel. You're not able to remove the decay heat, and you wind up rupturing the fuel rods that releases the fission products. The fission products then come out into the containment. And one of the things that also happens is that now you're getting very hot fuel and very hot zirconium, and that is going to react with the steam, and it makes hydrogen gas, and then that can go into the containment and combust. And so it's not clear precisely how the hydrogen got into the containments, but it filled this so-called refueling bay business area, which is up at the top, and formed a flammable mixture. Hydrogen is a very flammable gas. It has a very wide flammability range and very small ignition energy. And so the consequence of that was, as we know, that there were explosions. This is some footage from Fukushima TV. There was a static TV camera there, and what you're going to see is over here next to this, the third from the right, tower. That was the explosion that took place in the top of Unit 1, and that generated a very large cloud of steam, and some of that is also concrete dust, because the panels, the structures that enclose the top of that bay were made out of concrete and steel. Yes, yeah. But turns out the radioactivity was released in the environment, both by these explosions and also some of it just leaked out of various paths as the, because as the reactors boiled off the water, they overheated. So the temperatures went up high enough to fail the seals, and the pressure went up high enough to actually lift some of the sealing surfaces, which are normally bolted in place. And so there are a number of leakage paths. The other thing that happens is once you have the explosions, then you don't have these containment of leakage. This is the explosion of Unit 3. You can see it happens behind that second vent stack. Those vent stacks are about 300 feet high. They're about 100 meters, just for scale. So you can see this plume goes way up in the air. And if you look carefully, you can see some very large portions of debris. Now, these explosions did not happen in the reactor. They happened in the reactor building. They destroyed structures that were above the reactor. They were not the reactors themselves. But what they did do was they created a very difficult environment to work. They tremendously frightened the operators and the other folks, the firefighters and the mechanics and people that were there. It also created a fear that something really much more dramatic even might happen here. And there was, it really created an extraordinarily difficult environment to work. And at one point, they wound up evacuating many of the personnel because they weren't sure what was going to happen. They had a fourth explosion, which was not recorded on video. It happened early in the morning, and it happened in Unit 4. And that explosion happened apparently because some of the hydrogen from Unit 3 went into Unit 4. This is sort of the timeline of what happened. It all really took place between about almost 3 o'clock in the afternoon on the 11th until sometime in the early morning on the 15th. They still grappled, of course, to bring this all under control for weeks and months and years afterwards, and still doing that today. But this was a really dramatic period of time, and you can see the timing of the operation of the cooling systems, the RC up on the top in Unit 1, passive system only operated for a short period of time. The core melted immediately, and then they had the hydrogen explosion. In Unit 2, the system that actually operated for much longer than it was ever designed to, but ultimately that system failed. There was not an explosion there. It's not really quite understood exactly what happened in Unit 2 in that regard. But Unit 3, they had two systems that ran, and ultimately both of those systems were not operational anymore for various reasons. And after the core melted and they were unsuccessful at being able to vent the system to reduce the pressure, they had an explosion there. And then the hydrogen from Unit 3 went into Unit 4 and they had another explosion. So that's the history of what happened. And then here's the end result after an extraordinarily traumatic week. And of course, one of the things to keep in mind is all during this time, was this enormous civil emergency, because they'd have this tsunami. Over 15,000 people died. There were 6,000 people that were injured. And it was destroyed an enormous amount of the infrastructure, which made it extremely difficult to respond to this. And they were coping with all of that. Many of the workers here, it was not clear to them. They did not know if their families were even alive. But now you can see the extent of the destruction that took place here.
All those plumes towards populated areas or out to sea?
So the prevailing winds were, thankfully, for the most part, blowing it out into the Pacific. But it did. Well, it turns out it's a long way between here and there. And the Pacific Ocean is a pretty good diluting factor. But yeah, there were some ships offshore, and in fact, there's some sailors right now that are suing about that because they believe they were exposed due to the fallout from that. But there was fallout in a streak that went up to the northeast over the towns that were there, yeah. And so it went in an area, and the thing that was particularly damaging was it was an area where it was a rural communities, but it's fairly populated still because Japan is concentrated along the coast there. It rained, and it blew inland, and it rained. It was very bad luck. And so the areas that are extensively contaminated, and I'll show those next after I get through talking about the destruction of the plant, were due to primarily to that. Okay, so here's the destruction of Unit 1. You can see how it, if you look over here, on the right-hand side, you can see where the spent fuel is. And that spent fuel is indicated schematically by these blocks that are there. And there's a crane system that can move it in and out of the reactor. And so that's why they located that. And that's a swimming pool. It's full of water. This is what Unit 3 looked like when it was all done. This is a view of Unit 4, and this is a close-up, and that green piece of equipment you see there is part of the equipment that's used to deal with the moving around heavy things for the fuel handling. And this is an example of some of the damage you get from the explosion in Unit 4. There was a great deal of concern, of course, and very rightfully so, about the extent of the contamination. And the Japanese responded, I would say, given the circumstances, they responded in an extremely effective way. There were a lot of concerns that some towns were not evacuated as promptly as they should have been, but many people were. And there was a lot of screening that's taking place. And now they have a longitudinal study, and they're going to follow many of the members of the exposed population for the rest of their lives. And so they've ultimately taken this issue very seriously. Here's a picture of the contamination. And this shows, so north is up here, and you can see this the area that's to the northeast through Nami and over to Ilate village and that area. That's the area that was very heavily contaminated and where the evacuations took place. You can see there was a series of evacuations at different times. One of the criticisms was that this area that's in the red was evacuated much later than some of the earlier areas. This is what the actual extent of the physical contamination looks like in terms of the deposition of radionuclides. The primary radionuclides that are of concern here is cesium-134 and 137. 134 has half-life 2 years. It's 137 with a 30-year half-life that you're really concerned with. It also binds to the soil. It's extremely hard to get out. You have to basically scrape up the soil and put it in a landfill. There's not much you can do with it. You can wash it off the houses. You can wash it off the concrete. But all you can do with the soil is bag it up. So there's huge mounds of bags of soil scattered around the Fukushima province. And now there's a big discussion about how they're going to dispose of that. So what do they have to do now? Well, they got a lot of jobs to do. It's basically made TEPCO bankrupt. The government's had to step in and support a lot of this. They've got to keep that fuel is still in there with decay heat. You got to keep it cool. You got to pump water in there. It's just you don't know where it is anymore. You've got a lot of contamination. You need to stop that. You need to close up the buildings. You need to figure out how the contamination is getting in the water. If you're going to try to actually remediate this site, which is their goal, you've got to clean it up on site. You've got to clean up from all of this contamination that's off site due to the rain out from the plumes. There's a lot of open structures, a lot of damaged structures. You've got spent fuel, not only the molten fuel from the reactors themselves, but you've got the spent fuel that's in the spent fuel pools and the reactors. You've got to get that out and store that someplace else. And then ultimately their goal was to do what we did at Three Mile Island, which is to clean that up to the point where they can decommission the site and have it to some extent confine the heavily contaminated part to a very small area and the rest of it will be usable. It's a really daunting task. In fact, they're thinking that, you know, this is basically going to be lifetime employment for everybody that's working on it. It's probably going to take them, they think, 40 years. It could take even longer. Three Mile Island was a walk in the park compared to this, and it took us about 14 or 15 years to get it completely decommissioned.
And to compare it with Chernobyl, they just walled off the town and said,
yeah, there's Chernobyl, in some sense, there's no comparison. Chernobyl was they entombed the reactor there, but they also never really effectively decontaminated the area. It's just, they just basically made it a preserve. And, you know, you can go there as a nuclear tourist. I'm not enthusiastic about that, but it's possible to go there.
The HE plant, one of the more advanced, it was like an old design, it was pretty modern and
no, it was one of the first plants they built. In fact, Unit 1 was the first plant they built in Japan. And those Mark 1s are the first generation of reactors. It's Generation 1. Yeah. They have some Mark 2s that are up the way. Yeah, they have very few Gen 3 plants in Japan. Yeah.
The original one was built in the 50s by GE?
No, 1970 was when it started. They were building it in the 1960s. It took them probably about 5 years to build it. And the design was done by GE. It was a GE design. And GE built the first one. The subsequent ones were built by Toshiba and Hitachi, depending on who built it. GE also built a couple of the other ones.
The more modern design would have fared better, or was it just this?
Well, the more modern designs, for example, are very closely related to the Unit 1. They have, so if you look at the AP1000 and the other designs, they have a very large pool of water, and it's designed to use natural convection to cool it. But you got to make sure the valves are open. You got to make sure your logic system doesn't fail. And so, you know, that's really the devil is in the details about these things.
It lasted longer.
Unit 2 lasted longer, and a lot of these things are kind of luck of the draw. That's because they had turned on that Rixey pump, and that pump was running at the time the power failed. And even though the governor failed on that pump, it continued to run for a very long time. And one of the things that the folks who are in the nuclear engineering building business are trying to do is, why did it work for so long? there's a lot to be learned from this. But they're also engaged in all this effort simultaneously. They're trying to clean up all the rubble. This is a sign that says there's 1,000 millisieverts an hour here. That'll kill you if you stand next to this for a few minutes. And so you don't want to go there. They invested heavily in making robotic machinery. This is actually a robotic truck and a robotic loader, and it's all being run by, and this is a robotic crane, and these things are all being run by young guys that are sitting at consoles that look like very elaborate video game consoles. And there's been a tremendous effort to use robotics to clean up here. Now, water. I want to say a few things about water. And it takes water to keep these things cool. And we've talked about that extensively. But even after the fuel is all molten and we don't even know where it is, we still need to make sure we got to keep it cool. And so what they've been doing is basically pumping water into the reactor. It goes somewhere, hopefully around the fuel, and then we pump it back out of the bottom of the building. Now, what's happening, though, is something that's really quite, in hindsight, it's perfectly reasonable, but was unexpected at the time. This was built on an alluvial floodplain. There's a very large underground river of water that comes down from the mountains there in Fukushima. And there's 400 tons a day, and that water flows through the building and co-mingles with the water that they're pumping through there to cool those molten cores. And it becomes contaminated and then flows out into the ocean. And so they have a terrific problem trying to control this. And if you look in this, you can see the enormous number of tanks that are scattered all around in the background. What they've been doing is pulling that water out, storing it in tanks as best as they can, and trying to treat it. That they're also trying to figure out how to keep the water from intruding into the basements of this building where there's unknown openings. And to do that, they've constructed a wall out of ice. And so they've drilled down. And now the problem with that is they've placed a very large number of basically heat exchangers with freezing the ground. But if you miss any spots, then the water's going to get through. So it has to be extremely complete in order to work. I think they're actually using ammonia. You don't need it to get it that cold. And so it's a little easier to handle ammonia. So it's like a big meat locker refrigeration plant. You know, but it's been an enormous engineering enterprise, but they have had a lot of difficulty trying to make that work. They've also built extensive decontamination plants to try to decontaminate the water, because ultimately they're not going to be able to store all this water. They're going to have to release it back into the Pacific, and that's going to cause a lot of consternation in the international community. But they're just going to run out of space to put it. It's just not physically possible to do that. And one of the real difficulties in is to get out all the cesium, of course, and then there's other things that are even harder to get out. For example, there really is no effective technological way to remove tritium. And so the tritium is essentially something that we have no way to chemically separate at any at this kind of scale. And so you're just stuck with the tritium. And so the water will be contaminated with tritium when they release it. But you can likely get out the cesium and the strontium and some of the other bad actors. There's some of the treated water and where it's stored. Finally, they want to actually, imagining that, you know, they'll get all of these things under control. They'll clean up all the rubble. They've done a good job on that. They'll be able to figure out how to handle the water, and then they'll be able to go in there, find the molten fuel, and take it out. Now, what they had to do at Three Mile Island is, you know, imagine this is a refractory material, right? This is a very high melting point oxidic material, and you have to use a diamond drill bit and go in there and basically drill it out. But you got to find it before you can do that. That's what we did at Three Mile Island. So there, in the process, they have a large research effort, first of all, to find it using robotics. One of the challenges is if you put your little camera down there, that you'll find that the radiation field pretty quickly causes the pixels to start to go white, and then it all dies. And so your robotics don't live for very long. You can't use robotics which are radio operated. They have to have a tether, because you cannot get your radio waves through all the steel that's in the concrete and in the structure. So there's some real challenges there. But there's a lot of people that are working feverishly on trying to do this. And just the other day, they managed to get a robot down into the bottom of one of the units. And they, sure enough, they saw some black crud down there that they think is part of the core. And so they're beginning to find out where the stuff is. And, you know, one of the things they've also tried to do is they have some simulation programs, and they've tried to figure out where did it all go. They think in Unit 1 it all ran down to the bottom and ran out through the openings and went down onto the floor, and they're not really sure where it is in Units 2 and 3, but there's various possible things that could have happened. They've also tried to use things like muons to take images of it. Muons are occurring naturally, and you can get them from other sources, and you can get very large detectors, and you just sit there and average for a long time. It's basically like a pinhole camera, but it's a really lousy resolution, and so it's really hard to see, but it doesn't look like the fuel's inside the reactors anymore. So they had a lot of spent fuel there, and they made a lot of efforts to get the spent fuel out. Spent fuel is in these swimming pools that are next to the reactors. They've also got a large common pool that they use to store it in. And there's an enormous amount of radioactivity in these spent fuel pools. And this is something that's of concern in the United States. We have the same situation in the United States. We don't have a geologic repository, so we're continuing to store the fuel. Some of it has been put into what's called dry cask storage, but much of it is in the pools that are next to the reactors. So this is my only slide with equations on it, so we have to do some engineering here, right? And so basically it's just mass and energy balance. If you have a pool and you're not cooling it, you'll evaporate the water. And so they had to put water into the pools. This is one of the ineffectual efforts. They finally used concrete pump trucks and put a video camera on the end of it so they could see where they're putting the water and managed to keep the pools full of water. If you don't keep the pools full of water, this is a Unit 4 pool. It would have boiled off in about 16 days. And if it boils off, the same thing will happen as happens in the reactor. You'll eventually start oxidizing the zirconium. It'll heat up. You can either burn it in air or you can burn it in steam. And none of these things are good. This is a very bad day. And so it's important to keep these pools filled and cooled. And this is an example of what they had to do. They built a complete superstructure around Unit 4 and built a whole new system cantilevered over the damaged reactor building. It's completely independent, has more steel in it than the Tokyo Tower, in order to pull the spent fuel out and transfer it into casks. And then they took those casks over and they transferred it into the other pools that were not damaged in Units 5 and 6, and also the common pool. So this is an example of what one of these fuel assemblies looks like. It's a set of these 12-inch long zirconium tubes that are about as big around as your little finger, and inside of them are the pellets of uranium dioxide. And what was really remarkable is all of these things appear to have survived unscathed, even though in some cases a lot of debris, particularly in Unit 3, fell into the pool. In fact, the whole multi-ton fuel handling machine fell into that pool. So what are some of the lessons for us? I'm going to finish up here. It's a very expensive business to have one of these things happen. It's, you know, the direct cost to Japan, they're now thinking are on the order of maybe probably $180 billion. That's, and you know, how you actually calculate that is something that is in some dispute, but you can see all the things that go into that. And these are just projected. They still got a long way to go before they're able to do some of these things like decommissioning. They had to buy a lot of electricity. Remember, they were making almost 30% of their electricity from nuclear power. And so the replacement cost of the electricity is very substantial. It's almost as much at this point as they expect that accident to cost them. There are indirect economic costs that have to do with the fact that it really substantially affected tourism, the livelihoods of the fishermen that are there on that coast. There's a very big social cost to the families that were displaced. And there's been a tremendous loss of confidence in the government and in TEPCO and in the nuclear, so-called nuclear village in Japan, which was a very substantial part of the plans for Japan to meet the Kyoto goals in terms of their carbon output. They will, you know, now are trying to understand how it's going to be possible to be able to meet the goals. They were planning to ramp up and increase the number of nuclear power plants and actually go to probably something like 60 or 70% at least nuclear power for generating electricity. Right now, every plant but one is shut down. and it's not clear when if any of those plants are going to start operating again. They're bringing in fossil fuels. They're bringing in natural gas from Indonesia. They're buying coal from China, and they've got a little bit of oil coming in from the Middle East.
I'm also curious about the public perception. TEPCO's a private company with some government.
Well, TEPCO was a private company, but it's been pretty well taken over by the government.
So therein lies kind of the conundrum that it's built as this very efficient, 35 tons of fuel, and you get all this power, but a disaster like this is well beyond any insurance they have, so it's coming to the government and the people.
Yes, and that's actually ultimately goes to the people of Japan. And so the ratepayers are actually going to really get stuck with a lot of this, is my understanding. Yeah.
Go ahead. Is there at 4 o'clock, we have time for like one or two questions.
Yep.
Compared to Chernobyl, it could have been worse.
Do you see any possibilities, companies like Microsoft helping any way at all? From a technology standpoint?
Well, I think that there is an important role in that, for example, today, we have a little bit less than 100 reactors operating in the United States. And there's a project to replace the analog control rooms with digital control rooms. One of the things that's really critically important is the reliability of those systems, both from a hardware and a software point of view. And so I think all the efforts that people have made through the years need to really come together in a very concerted way in order to be able to demonstrate that those instrumentation and control systems have the degree of reliability and do not suffer the kinds of faults that we saw in some of the analog systems that were there. And I think it's a very important and a very challenging task. I mean, you have got to ensure over a very large range of conditions, including some corner conditions that, many folks will say, well, that'll never happen, that you're going to be able to assure that the software and the hardware are going to do the right thing. So that's one of the challenges that I see. The other challenge is understanding how to create reliable real-time simulation so you can help the operators. I didn't show the picture, but there were probably thousands of people in the operating center and working in the control centers that are right next to the reactors, trying to feed information back to the superintendent and all the engineers that were working under him to try to understand what was happening. And so you had a really classic problem in trying to diagnose a very complex system with very incomplete information. And so one of the questions is, can you build a simulation of this system that will enable you, using some ideas from AI and decision making, to take that confusing, often sometimes contradictory information, because it's coming from people's observations, it's not just measurements, and measurements themselves may be wrong because the instruments may be damaged. And can you put that into a model of what you think the plant is doing and use that to give good advice to the operators and the superintendent of where should I put my resources? It's a problem in resource allocation. He's got four plants. He actually had six plants which were simultaneously involved in extremely severe conditions, much of which was unknown to him. And so now he's trying to make decisions about what to do. And so this is an area that we identified. We did a study. I worked with the National Academy of Science, and we did two studies on this. And one of the things that we identified was trying to make some progress in this area of how do we build something that's more than just a classic expert system, but a modern expert system that's coupled to simulation that can help give advice in this very complex environment.
Great. Thanks so much.